The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold. Shugen Roshi is the abbot of both the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or to find out more about our various programs, please visit us online at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
So we are in the middle of our week of Sesshin, in the twilight of our Ango. and accompanied by the autumn change. I always enjoy the first moment, the first morning in spring when officiating, when the sun comes right through that window as it begins to move up. And in the fall, watching the sun walk along the horizon towards the south as it rises lower and lower in the sky. And that particular autumn light, which is so particular, so different from the light of spring and the sunlight of summer. And so here, as we come towards the end of these verses, where Tsongpo has taken us through this sort of tour of various ways in which we get caught up in things and how to enact, bring forth, enliven our vows to use those very things, those particular moments, to see into our hindrance and to free ourselves, and to, at the same time, to turn that around for others. And so here, towards the end, he brings our attention to our karmic afflictions. Shantideva said, "When I am beleaguered by afflictions, I will stand and face them in 1,000 ways. And likewise, I, whatever dangers may come, must not fall down beneath my affliction's power." And affliction is a very powerful word, right? It's very evocative. It's something that causes pain and suffering. The root word, going back to Middle English and Latin, means to knock about or get knocked about or be harassed, which is kind of appropriate for how our afflictive emotions can affect us. So whatever dangers may come, Shantideva says, I must not fall down beneath their power, but will stand and face them in 1,000 ways. So how do we stand and face them? And why are these emotions so powerful? Right? This curious, such powerful and present aspect of being a human being. And it seems that other creatures, other animals, experience something that we might think of as emotions, sadness, grief, delight. But we know, or should know, mostly about our own. How is it that they are so powerful? And where does that power come from? When you hear the sound of the Han calling you to the Zendo, is the sound in the wooden block being struck, or is it in your ear? When you bite into an apple, is the sweetness in the apple, or is it in your tongue? When your legs hurt, is the pain in your leg? If it is, which would seem self-evident, why does the mind suffer so? If the pain is in your leg, then why, when the mind becomes undisturbed, does the pain in your leg no longer afflict you? In short, what the hell's going on? These afflictive emotions, which are such an essential part of Buddhist teaching, the kleshas, are kind of a veil of emotional conflict, a veil over the heart, over the body, over our mind, over things. These afflictive emotions can cast a veil not only over ourselves, but over things, people, situations. And a veil, you know, diminishes the light. It makes something comes through. There are images that come through the veil, but there's a concealment. And part of the importance, one of the important aspects of these emotions is not they in and of themselves, but what we do with them, because of them, how they lead us or incite us, inspire us, you might say, to all kinds of thoughts, words, and actions that are not often helpful. And because of the power of these emotions that we have, and particularly the more difficult, challenging, so-called negative emotions, they can elicit fear, another emotion, because of just the arising of it and the fear, the association we might have with it, the fear of what happens next, of what we will do within that emotion. And the fear is always based in not actually seeing it. You know, it's interesting how we can simultaneously know that we are feeling a certain way, sadness, anger, irritation, and not know it at the same time. In other words, not know it. We can have a sense or have a kind of awareness that an emotion has arisen, that something is happening, but not actually be making contact with it. He says, once you become accustomed to the karmic afflictions, once you become accustomed, and it's striking how quickly that happens, how quickly we become accustomed to things, how easily things become habits within us. How something that begins as a new experience becomes familiar with repetition. And it doesn't require a lot of repetition. It becomes familiar, it becomes ordinary. And when it becomes ordinary, in a subtle way, we don't notice it too much anymore, which is how it becomes habitual. When it starts to disappear from our awareness, it's becoming more habitual. And in a subtle way, then it becomes expected, which is a part of how we identify with it. When something happens again and again, we expect that it will happen because it does. And here it is. So our expectation is fulfilled and strengthened, which is another way of saying that it becomes a sense that we have of who we are, ourself. We are someone who has this experience, has this emotion, responds in this way. And when this repetition happens within samsara, within not understanding, then we can become accustomed within samsara to almost anything, it seems, which is kind of amazing, really. And so we become accustomed to dukkha, to all the various kinds of suffering and sorrow and sadness. At the same time that we can lash out at them, at those emotions and those aspects of suffering, they become normal, which means ordinary, expected. And in that expectancy, self-fulfilling. And so what begins as something that seems to be happening to us can pretty quickly become something that we become the agent for ourselves. And that all of that can be happening quite beyond our view. Again, that capacity we have to be actively engaged in something, doing something, and have a sense of it on one hand, but not really understanding or seeing it clearly on the other. When there is repetition within the Dharma, within practice, within right understanding and a great aspiration, then we can become accustomed to anything, at ease, to sitting in stillness for extended periods of time, to taking this mountain form. We can become accustomed to being awake and relaxed at the same time. We can become accustomed and at ease within a prostration, within mindfulness, within compassion for others. What's the difference between becoming accustomed within repetition, within samsara, and within practice? Our mind. One true action, true because it's in accord with the Dharma, which means it's in accord with the way things truly are, versus an unwholesome, unskillful, unaware, based in our afflictive emotions action. Dudin Chodron on this verse says, in her commentary, said, this verse acknowledges the fact that habitual disturbing emotions are hard to stop through counteractions. In the Tibetan tradition, often the teachings often speak of antidotes, that sort of following that way of describing the Buddha as the great physician who recognized the fundamental illness of dukkha and attachments and a false sense of self, and then the treatment, the path. And so these afflictions or all of our suffering are basic different aspects of our illness. And so then, having an illness, you counter it with an antidote. If you've gotten bit by a poisonous snake, you then want an antidote serum to heal you. She says, but the habitual disturbing emotions are hard to stop just through counteractions, unless we have the wisdom directly realizing their fundamental nature, emptiness. It's hard to cut their roots. We can't cut their roots. So until we have that wisdom, we have to be armed with the guards of mindfulness and mental alertness. Mindfulness and mental alertness. And these counter actions or practice, which is really what that means, is described in three different ways. It really sort of speaks about different ways of responding skillfully that generally refer to our where we are along the path. And then in the beginning, and if you think of these, remember back to these verses, you see this laid out in these verses. So in the beginning, there's the response or the skillful practice of avoiding that which brings forth these afflictive emotions. And so think of those early verses that talked about avoiding friends who aren't really friends and just sort of lead you into, precarious states of mind or places or situations. And so, in a sense, the avoiding practice is recognizing that, in a sense, there's a certain kind of danger here and that we're not quite ready to practice that well. We can practice it as best we can if we must, but it's recognizing we're not quite ready to practice it well. And so there's the practice of just avoiding those situations, those relationships, those life things that are going to basically really bring those emotions forward, make it very hard for us to practice. I was telling somebody earlier, I remember years ago I was talking to Dada Roshi in the Dokusan room about something, about working with some difficulty. I don't remember what it was. And he told me about a story that he was in years before he was ever a practitioner in his earlier life, where he was in a particular situation where something was introduced into the situation that he knew he did not have the sort of the inner strength or the moral sort of, you know, fortitude to be in that environment, to be in the situation with that thing, and sort of stay upright. He knew that if he remained in that situation, he would end up acting in a way that he did not want to. In other words, he knew that he wasn't strong enough to sort of deal with that situation. And so he did what he needed to do to change the situation, to sort of remove that element. And that was a kind of a revelation to me. I mean, it seems so simple. But as a practitioner at that early point in my career, you know, and sort of being, you know, full of the Dharma and not all in the right ways, I was sort of operating under the assumption that no matter what, you know, you meet the obstacle and you make it work. And he was saying, no, sometimes, you know, you're not really ready to meet that obstacle. And so if you can, don't. Wait. And that, it was such a sort of a ordinary kind of wisdom, right? I was like, oh, thank you. It's like a humility, you know, a recognition of what we're ready for and what we may not be. And then there's the practice of as he speaks in the verse, of eliminating, to eliminate afflictions the moment they arise, which is basically how we practice, to recognize, to not deny or ignore, but not to get caught up in, to release our grasp, to turn towards and face, if we cannot let it go. And our emotions are of the stuff that they are not so easy to let go of. And to stand and face in 1,000 ways. And so that basic teaching, the basic principle of not denying and not grasping, which is so profound, has 1,000 faces. There are many different ways in which that will need to be practiced, given different situations, different challenges, at different times by different people. It's one of the reasons face-to-face teaching is so important, is to be able to speak directly and try and help a student directly with something particular, which that can then be sort of observed over time to see how is that skillful, is that effective for them. And then the last and most sort of decisive is to realize, to see that the fundamental nature of that obstacle is not obstructive. In other words, that within that afflictive emotion, it alone does not have the power to bind us, because it is not alone. There is nothing alone about it. We are actively co-creating that emotion. In the Transmission of Light, there's a case where Daojin comes to his teacher, Sengsan, and says, give me a way to liberation. How can I free myself? And Sengsan said, what is binding you? And Daojin said, nothing is binding me. After exhaustive searching to find what is it that was binding him, he came back and he said, nothing is binding me. And Sengsan said, then why do you seek liberation? Unless we have the wisdom directly realized in emptiness, we can't cut their roots. Why is that so? Why can't we, just with our determination and our will and our steady practice of non-attachment, why isn't that sufficient? It is very powerful and very effective and absolutely necessary. And it will take us so far. It will not cut the roots. Those roots being our long-held beliefs, the things we have faith in, our views, still persist largely because we don't even know we have them. We don't know how we are operating under And within so many of these fundamental views of ourself and the world, they've just been so, they're so old and they're so integrated. And so our habits change. The state of our mind changes with practice. The way we respond as things arise changes. To soften, to grow weaker, to begin to erode. But the underlying basis, the roots, like a tree, that which is underneath the ground that you don't see, still persists. And so she says, until we have that wisdom, we have to be armed with the guards of mindfulness and mental alertness. And she says that mindfulness means different things in different contexts. Here it means the mindfulness of the bodhisattva practices, of our vows, precepts, aspiration. Until you have that wisdom. Now, know that you will never have this wisdom. You cannot have it. It is nothing but you, but you cannot possess it. It is nothing that you will ever acquire. It is not something that is absent and then becomes present. Practice realization is non-dual. It's a ceaseless path. It's a continuum of discovery, of freeing ourselves. And so there are moments when, like a flash of lightning in the middle of a dark night, when the whole landscape is illuminated. And then there's the coming light of the dawn that is so imperceptible. You can't see it, but there are moments where you realize it's getting lighter. It's getting lighter. But there's no moment that you can point to in which that's happening. Both of these are true. What does wisdom reveal about these afflictive emotions? That the idea of eliminating them, of stopping them, of cutting them off is based in that view that these are things that are happening to me. They're causing me distress. If I can get them to stop happening, if I can get them to go away, then I'll be free of them. And so we do practice on the basis of that. We try and let them go, right? As though they are something that has, you know, a body that we can let go of. But ultimately we see, and emotions in particular sort of defy that sense of things, right? Thoughts are, by their nature, much easier, much more like objects. Emotions, much less so. As long as they continue to appear as something that is real, that are self-empowered, that are causing us harm, then it's natural that we would want to eliminate them. And so in the Heart Sutra, we chant, no suffering, no afflictive emotions, no cause of afflictive emotion, no extinguishing, no path. And so while we are practicing on this path, we bring mindfulness and awareness. So mindfulness is to the capacity of bringing our attention into focus on one thing. And this idea of focusing on, Thanissaro Bhikkhu says, there's no word in the early teachings that says that. Focus on. The word anupassana means to follow seeing, sorry, to follow after what we see, to stay with what we see. And he says that refers to two different aspects of meditation. One is to be able to keep awareness on, keep watching over a particular subject of our meditation, like the breath. And he says, in particular, in the midst of other experiences. So there are other things that are happening. You might be having sensations in your body, or hear sounds, or somebody next to you shifts. And you're able to hold that awareness on that breath, on that object, without losing it. And the other aspect is to look for a particular quality in experiences as they arise. And so in the Satipatthana Sutra, the four foundations of mindfulness, the Buddha says those four aspects, those four things that we practice bringing our attention to is the body, the breath, feelings, sensations, your mind, and your mind objects. And the second aspect is to look for a particular quality is more based in insight. So for instance, to see the arising and passing of things within, and to see that as impermanence. And the thing about emotions is that is how they are by nature embodied, right? They are in your body. They occupy the body and mind, the body and mind. And so we practice this mindfulness within the four postures of the Buddha, sitting, standing, walking, lying down. We practice it within our awareness. We practice letting go. We practice returning. We practice atonement. We practice forgiveness. We practice taking responsibility. And throughout the course of the day, those things are happening all the time. You bump into somebody, and there's a very simple practice of atonement and forgiveness. Right? It might even go unnoticed, but it should happen. Right? Excuse me, it's okay. Taking responsibility. And then there are larger moments. We practice it in our zazen, in our working, in our liturgy. For those of you at home, you're, I hope, trying to practice this throughout your day as you intermingle with people who may be living in your house. Four-leggeds, two-leggeds, with your work, as you move back and forth between silence and speaking, between not thinking and thinking. And we do it within the context of our precepts, the moral teachings within for monastics, our monastic vows, the commitments we make in session, the commitments residents make as part of residency, the commitments students make as being a training student. All of our mindfulness and practice is happening within context of all of this. That's what makes it a path, an eightfold path. All of these things are working together. And within this mindfulness, the ability to bring our attention to where it needs to be, which sometimes the moment tells you that, demands that. And sometimes you choose. And within that mindfulness, there is also alertness. And so alertness, Thubten Trojan says, is an aspect of your mindfulness, your awareness, in which you are aware of what you're saying and thinking and feeling and doing. It helps to alert you when you wander away from that, when you're not aware of what you're saying or doing. It helps us to see if we're, she says, if we're actually living in accord with our intentions. It reminds me, a student came in once to Dokusan and said that they had stopped sitting. They'd fallen off from sitting. And I said, well, how long ago? And it was like, I don't know, a while. And I said, well, did it happen all at once or was it sort of gradual? And they said, I don't really remember. And I said, well, when do you normally sit? And they just looked at me. And I said, so you don't really have any particular time when you plan to sit each day? And they said, no. And I said, well, no wonder you have wandered away, because there was nothing to wander towards. I said, you need to establish, right? Unless that way of working, that sort of formless intention is working for you, then use it, but it doesn't seem to be working. So I said, if you establish just a time when you're going to sit, then when you wake up, that's in your mind, right? That's there in front of you. And now you have to negotiate with that, right? You're either moving towards it or you're moving away from it, but you're engaged in something particular, right? There's something to be mindful of, which is that intention to sit, let's say, after you get up and have a cup of tea. But without that, there's nothing to be mindful of to bring you to your cushion and practice mindfulness. So the whole thing is kind of set up to not bring you closer. The Buddha talked about alertness, this quality within mindfulness. He said there's the case where feelings are known. You're having a feeling, a sensation. You know that as it arises, you see it as it arises, you see it as it becomes established, as it persists, and then you see it as it dissipates. You know that this is happening within you. Thoughts arise, and you see them as they arise, and you see them as they persist, and then you see them as they depart. Perceptions arise and persist and depart. That all of this is known to the student. This is how a student is alert. And then he says, when going forward and returning, be alert. When looking toward or looking away, do that within your alertness. In other words, know that you are doing that. And this is not a kind of a nitpicky, you know, fussy, thing. It's very relaxed. It's very natural. It's our natural mind. But until it's natural, we have to be deliberate about it. When you're bending and extending your limbs, when you're bowing, when you're carrying your robe, putting it on, when you're eating, drinking, chewing, and savoring, when you're urinating and defecating throughout the 24 hours of the day, this is how you make yourself alert. This is how you occupy your life. You reclaim it. And then because there are moments where things arise and we don't know, is this helpful or not? Is this skillful? Should I strengthen this? Or should I let this go? Right? This happens all the time in all kinds of ways, particularly when students have experiences, right? A kind of experience out of your meditation where something happens that is different or new, and you want to know, is this something I should be developing? Is this something I should just let go of? And the Buddha called that ardency, the ability to recognize what is actually beneficial. And the Buddha says this, a person without ardency, because there's a moral quality here, there's the quality of knowing whether this is actually helpful, not just in terms of, you know, developing your concentration, but in terms of your compassion, in terms of living well, of not creating harm and practicing good, which is completely connected to your mindfulness and concentration. And so this ardency is sort of the moral aspect of your meditation. And he says, without this, without compunction, that is, the ability to feel remorse, a person is incapable of self-awakening. Now, that's a very strong statement. Incapable of unbinding, incapable of attaining the unsurpassed safety from bondage. So in other words, he's saying, if that's not alive and present within us, in a certain sense, if our heart is not open, if we don't care, not just about our own experience and how we are being affected, but how we are affecting others, then we can't actually do this. That element is essential, is integral to the whole thing. You know, as though we could sort of put that over here and just do our concentration, get enlightened, and then we'll come back and work out our compassion. The Buddha is saying that is impossible. That is a gross misunderstanding of the path. And while people may do meditation in which that's what's happening, it's not Buddhist meditation. See, that's the thing. So it's just another way of saying that experiencing wounding, feeling the pain, feeling regret, is essential. Not that we should do something so that we can have that experience as though it's somehow noble in and of itself, but that when, just as things are happening and we're just doing our life and practice, that comes through our own actions, through the actions of others, that when that appears in our mind and we recognize it, that's what the Buddha called ardency. And that we are affected by that, he says, is essential. Without it, it is incapable. We are not capable of awakening, of unbinding. In other words, the heart must be open to suffering. It must be open to all of our relatedness to people and things. You know, which is not always exactly what we're looking for when we come to practice. Right? We're kind of hoping, you know, that we're going to get a big protective suit, or that somehow that's just going to go away and we won't have to feel that. But we might ask ourselves, but have we been feeling it? We've been feeling something, but what have we been feeling? Have we been feeling it, as the Buddha said, in and of itself? Or have we been feeling something which is really what we call afflictions? You know, in the teachings, emotions are presented as being really much, in a sense, much more important than thoughts. You know, we think thoughts are so important because, you know, they're yours. And because they're so smart. And because they're about things. You know, we think about things. And that's kind of cool, right? We think about things. And in that, things become more things. And they sort of get all dressed up, all gussied up, right? With our thinking. They become larger and fancy and, you know, complicated and interesting. And stories. And so our thoughts, you know, seem to have so much power. And of course they do. But the teachings say that emotions are actually much, much more instrumental here. Much more central. Much more influential. You know, thoughts may seem to lead to our actions, but is that really so? Or are they kind of the explanation of what we're already going to do or already done? What are the emotions underlying those very thoughts that are within them? And we can recognize it when we have thoughts, that they're thoughts. We are thinking them. I'm thinking this, right? And even if I didn't decide, okay, I'm going to have this thought, we recognize I am thinking. On some level, we recognize that that's happening. And then in that, they're my thoughts, right? And I can continue to think them or I can let them go. And so we realize that we have this kind of power, right, to exert some measure of influence. And we see them dissipate and they can quiet down and we can let them go. And so they kind of, you know, cooperate and sort of can become, you know, kind of tame as our awareness gets stronger. Emotions don't work like that so much. They just appear, right? And they appear with truth, right? They appear with a message, with meaning, right? When we think, the words are already filled with meaning. And the meaning is usually somewhat precise because that's the function of language. But our emotions can have all kinds of meaning, right? So when something arises, you're feeling emotion. It's like the question is, what does this mean? It could mean this or it could mean this. It could be because of this or because of that. And they seem to just happen without our doing. I didn't ask for this to come. I didn't decide a moment ago, okay, I'm going to feel sad right now. It doesn't work like that. Just suddenly, there's sadness. Where did that come from? What am I sad about? Why am I sad? What does it mean that I'm sad? What does this mean about what I'm sad about? What does it mean about me that I'm feeling sad? And because they inhabit the body and the mind, with all of that concern and questions, they're not so easily let go of. How do you let go of something that is occupying you? Right? Where would you go to grab hold of it and drop it? And do we even want to? Right? In that way that our afflictions become self-confirming, seemingly self-generating, we may very well not want to let them go because of what they mean to us, because of what they're leading us towards, because of what they're coming from. And in that emotion there, it's like the emotion is putting us into relationship with something. That which I'm feeling, but that what I am feeling about, and I may not want to let go of that. At the same time that I may be practicing trying to let go. And so there's that sort of pushing and pulling. And they seem so true, and in a way they are true. They are expressing. They're clearly expressing something. And when they're strong, when they're disturbing, when they're turbulent, they can shake the whole house. They can bring forth all kinds of other sort of corollary emotions, doubt, insecurity, helplessness, hopelessness, fear. And so to be able to bring our attention to that, maybe for the first time, to actually encounter not the story, not the meaning, but just the experience, the sensation, and to hold that in our bright awareness, and to know that we are feeling it, and to know where it is in the body, and to see it lingering, and to be aware of its strength, and to see how it wants to activate the mind, and perhaps does. And to know that, to see that clearly, and to be aware of that emotion, can it be helpful to you? How? Does it require action? How do you practice it? Do you sit in its presence? Do you let it go? Do you redirect your attention? Do you do metta practice? Why does Ongpo bring out this verse at the very end of his teaching? Right? We might think that he would start with this. It's like at the very beginning, okay, be alert, because everything else that's going to happen is based in this. Everything else I'm going to say, all these other verses are based in this. Maybe he brought it out at the end after having traveled through all of these different situations. Because if we've really studied them, if we've really reflected on this, if we have seen those, all those different verses alive within our lives, maybe now we realize, oh yeah, now I get it, how important this is. How I must be cultivating my mindfulness, how I must be able to see into this moment, into this body and mind, to be aware. And to know what is actually helpful, to be developing that wisdom. And that as we, you know, sometimes as people, students begin to turn towards and really begin to practice this well and begin to sort of develop their ability to do that and see how that is changing things, transforming on so many levels, there can be a kind of excitement, you know, an empowerment, an inspiration, a motivation that comes with that. And sometimes what happens is there's a subtle shift to where that's what my practice is. My practice is my emotions. In other words, there's a subtle shift of intention, a subtle shift of purpose. That's what practice is, right? It's just practicing my emotions. In the moment when they arise, yes. But in that way, as they become more and more familiar, they can become another expectation. An expectation of trying to elicit an emotion to arise so I can practice it. And there is a practice of that. But when that becomes our sense of what practice is, then we are sort of moving in a new direction, which is not going to be ultimately helpful. You know, this Dharma, there's not a single thing that is left out of Dharma, and there's not a single thing that it leaves out of you. There's not a single thing of you that it leaves out, right? That is not welcome, that is not understood, that we are not invited to encounter. Have you ever met anyone like that? Who's so profoundly, so unconditionally, right? In other words, nothing you can do will change that in the Dharma. You can be the worst rascal there is. The Dharma understands that more than we do. Have we ever met somebody who is that loving, that embracing? And so with sustained practice like this, it's inevitable that we will wander through some of the many worlds that exist within us and have so many opportunities to encounter. We should not let them pass by unnoticed.
Thanks for listening. Did you know that Zen Mountain Monastery is live streaming all Dharma talks and daily Zazen during the coronavirus quarantine? Visit our website to learn about all the online programs being offered at this time. Just go to zmm.org and click on the link at the very top of the page, or scroll down and click on Retreats.